inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
Today we welcome Carolyn Steele, architect and author of Zootopia, How Food Can Save the World, and 2013's Hungry City. She's an established influential voice across academia, industry, and the arts. Her 2009 TED Talk received over 1 million views, and she's lectured at leading institutions such as the University of Cambridge and the London School of Economics. In 2019, scientists warned that our civilization is in crisis, and that we can no longer feed our population a healthy diet while balancing planetary resources. In short, food is threatening our future. I'm your host, Miriam Plonsauer, Executive Strategy Director at AKQA in Copenhagen, and for this episode of AKQA Insight, I'll be talking to Carolyn about how food can save the world.
There's been a study, actually, undertaken in the UK in the last week by the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission, where they found that only 9% of people surveyed said they wanted life to go back as it was before, and 85% said they wanted to keep some aspects of their new life in lockdown. They're learning the joy of living in the moment, of contact with their loved ones, of spending time, simple time, you know. And again, the Stoics, who I mentioned earlier, I mean, they used to say acceptance of death is the start of a good life, because basically once you accept that your time on earth is limited, then you can live every day as if it's your last. And what I find really, really interesting is that what COVID is doing is it's making us value, understand, to see what really makes us happy.
Food played an important role in my upbringing. My dad is Jewish and he grew up in Spain, and in both of these cultures, mealtime is a big deal. It's something that brings families together, and it's the backbone of any social gathering, usually set to the sound of everyone interrupting each other in very loud voices. And on top of that, my parents were hippies who chose to live out in the countryside to be able to grow their own vegetables and lead as close to a self-sufficient, sustainable life as possible. Which meant that I learned early on to appreciate the taste of fresh food from the garden and to tell the difference from the stuff you could buy in supermarkets. So food and the quality of food and shared family meals have always had a special value to me, and it's something that I try to pass on to my own children today. But it wasn't until I read Carolyn Steele's book Zootopia that I understood the full meaning of it, of why it is mealtimes that make up my most vivid childhood memories and always bring with them a feeling of love and comfort. So I really enjoyed reading this book, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Carolyn Steele to AKQA Insight today. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi, Miriam. Many thanks for having me. Great pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So, Carolyn, the subtitle of your book is How Food Can Save the World. So maybe you could start telling me what's wrong with the world today? Why does it need saving?
Well, I mean, ironically, of course, you know, the world will be perfectly fine when our species departs the planet. But you know, at the moment, you know, I guess our concern is that the world that we know and love is under threat from the way we live. And there's many, many more humans on the planet than at any time in history, as you know. And we're facing a series of ecological catastrophes, effectively, and obviously climate change is something that everyone's very aware of, but no less worrying, in fact, is the threat of a sixth mass extinction, which we're on the brink of, and indeed some scientists say we've already entered, with catastrophic loss of insects and birds and, you know, basically the bottom of the food chain, due to the way we farm. Not just due to the way we farm, but I mean, it's a major contributor. So, and there are many, many other outcomes of the way we live and the way we eat, our use of energy, sort of mining wild areas. I mean, the late outbreak of COVID is very much related to this as well. The lack of biodiversity in our world, and also our encroachment on wild areas where we haven't historically been. So, you know, I think our relationship with nature, I mean, and I put that in inverted commas, because of course we are part of nature, but if you like, the sort of non-human living part of the world, our relationship with that is very out of balance. And, you know, it comes out of a sort of 250-year experiment called the Industrial Revolution, and we really need to address it. And that was very evident before COVID, but I think COVID's just made it much more visible to people.
Yeah, and you, it seems like food and our relationship to nature is part of the problem, but you speak of it also as a solution, and as food being a powerful tool to shape a better world. In what way is food a tool, and why is it food?
Yes, I mean, I invented this word Zootopia, which you mentioned at the beginning. I mean, the reason I invented that word is that when I was researching my previous book, Hungry City, I was looking at the way cities have been fed through history and how that shaped urban civilization. And I realized from that research that, you know, food shapes our ways in many more, our lives, I should say, in many more ways than we realize. So, for example, I mean, you know, if I try to put my trousers on after Christmas, I notice that food shaped my body. That's kind of obvious. As you said in your lovely introduction, you know, we sort of, as humans, we love to gather around a table with friends and family. This is when we feel most at home. And I guess some of us realize that, you know, cities are shaped by food. So, for example, on holiday, we might go and visit the market in a center of a city intuitively because, you know, we're drawn to the place where people, you know, historically have gathered to buy and sell food. And that seems to express something about society. And obviously, we're aware that our landscapes are shaped by food because, you know, you go into the countryside and you can see farmland and hedgerows and animals and so on. But it's much greater than even that, because food also shapes our economics, it shapes our value systems, it shapes our habits, you know, when we sort of how we pace ourselves through the day, it shapes our moods, it shapes our politics. So if you put all of that together, really, we live in a food-shaped world. And as I say, when I was researching Utopia, which is our greatest discipline of thinking in a multidisciplinary way about how we should live, I became very sort of upset and disturbed by the discovery that utopia is a joke word, because the U in it can either mean a good place from the EU, the Greek good, or no place from the Greek word OU, no. And so it's an ideal place that can't exist. And I just thought, well, that's kind of really sad, because we desperately need to think in a multidisciplinary way about how we should live. And if utopia can't exist, then kind of where are we? And I thought, well, you know, utopians themselves talk endlessly about food. They just don't kind of put food in the center of their thinking. But we could do that, you know, because we live in a world shaped by food. So I sort of rather cheekily came up with this word, Zootopia, which just means food, from the Greek word sitos, S-I-T-O-S, place. And the theory is that we basically live in a world shaped by food, but we live in a bad Zootopia, because we don't value food. You know, we've evolved this whole mindset where we think of food as cheap and we treat food as cheap, but actually there is no such thing as cheap food, which immediately becomes evident if you remind yourself that food consists of living things that we kill so that we can live. So if you put it like that, it reminds you that food is life, basically. And if we cheapen food, we cheapen life. So we live in a bad Zootopia. But if we start to value food again, then we can live in a better Zootopia. And by the way, an ideal Zootopia is utopia.
So, first of all, what does then a good Zootopia look like? What is a sustainable Zootopia?
And how
do we make sure it doesn't become a utopia as well?
Yeah. I mean, of course, utopia doesn't exist, so there's absolutely no danger of that, sadly or luckily, whichever way you can look at it. And basically, that's a very, very good question. I mean, I often use, there's an amazing fresco in Siena in the town hall, by Ambrogio Lorenzetti. It was painted in 1338, and it's called The Allegory of the Effects of Good Government. And that fresco, to me, and of course it is to a certain extent utopian, but it epitomises for me what a good Zootopia looks like. And basically what you see in this fresco is a stunning image of the city of Siena on the left-hand side and the countryside that feeds it on the right-hand side. And actually, I have to say, if you go to Siena now and you look out of the window of this, you know, it sits in the town hall, I should say, the main Sala de Nove, the main council chamber of Siena. And if you go to that council chamber and look out of the window, you see that very landscape, you know, so olive groves and wheat fields and vineyards and so on. But it's actually a landscape that's been, of course, artificially shaped in order to feed the city. But what's brilliant about this fresco and incredibly unusual, in fact, I don't know of a sort of similar example anywhere else in the world, and I'd be thrilled if somebody could point one to me. But what it shows is a complete balance between the city and the countryside. So they're given equal billing in the picture, if you like. And you can see a huge amount of trade passing, you know, through the city wall, you know, animals coming with grain on their backs and pigs being driven to market and a flock of sheep inside the city and so on. So really, this fresco, which is called The Allegory of the Effects of Good Government, is telling you that what the city elders understood, you know, back in the 14th century was that their job was to maintain a balance between the city and the countryside, because it is a partnership, a symbiosis, if you like, that lies at the basis of urban civilization. Now, of course, that's a painting. And what you're going to say to me is, yeah, but, you know, where does that exist in reality? Well, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, it did exist in reality in 14th century Italy, in the resurgence of the city-state. It's existed at various points during history, when people have valued food and you know, basically understood the importance of the balance between city and country. You know, I would say it exists in pockets all over the world now, wherever people value food. So, you know, for example, in the UK, we have a very kind of stratified food system. Most people in the UK just want their food to be as cheap as possible. But there's a small portion of the, you know, the population who actually value food and want to pay people to produce food ethically, that creates a beautiful landscape, you know, where they treat animals well and so on. So there's a sort of little subset of that. And if you go to an organic farm, you know, where people are farming with nature and not against it, or if you go to a farmer's market and, you know, where people are paying for good food, you know, made ethically and ecologically sustainably, then you see little pockets of the best possible Sitopia. And I guess I'm just interested in scaling that up to the greatest extent possible.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, because how do we make sure that it's not only the small pockets of people that are leading or living in a better Sitopia? I mean, who has the responsibility of reconfiguring our relationship with food, as you're talking about? If we look at the fresco in Siena, it's structural, it's a government. But is it up to the government, or is it an individual responsibility, or is it something we need to take collective responsibility of? I mean, how do we do this?
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's the sort of trillion-dollar question. And, you know, I mean, the thing is, I would say one of the great things about food is that we all eat. You know, we all have a great stake in this, haha, you know, S-T-E-A-K and S-T-A-K-E. You know, we all eat, so none of us can opt out of this. You know, every time you stick some food in your mouth, it's a political act, if you like. It's an ecological act. It's an economic act. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that it is absolutely about all of us doing something about this. So it's not only up to individuals, it's not only up to government, it's not only up to civic institutions, it's all of us. And, you know, for me, I believe this really, really strongly, actually. You know, every society bases all of its decisions and all of its behaviours on a value system of some sort. And we like to think that, you know, that our value system is based on fairness and equality. And I mean, you know, you read all the kind of supporting documentation to what a sort of free democracy ought to look like, for example. You know, it's all about sort of, you know, giving the best possible life for every citizen, which is obviously something that we sign up to by voting as voters. But it's also something that the government sort of takes responsibility for. Now, I just simply don't believe that if you can't afford to eat well, you can lead a good life. You know, I think eating well is the absolute foundation of a good life. And so we then have to examine, okay, why have we got a system where certain portions of the population don't eat well? You know, is it because they don't want to eat well, or is it because they don't have the knowledge or the possibility, or because they simply aren't earning enough to be able to afford the food? And of course, the answer, as always, is all of the above, you know, to a certain extent. So this is, again, the incredible power of food, is that it touches everything. It touches all of us. It's the only thing in our lives that connects us directly to nature and directly to one another, by which I mean physically. So by treating food as cheap, we've actually created this massive value schism at the heart of society, you know, because we've based everything, our lives, our idea of a good life, around the fact that food is cheap. And food is not cheap. You know, if you look at, as I said at the beginning, you know, the externalities of cheap food, they're totally unaffordable. You know, climate change is one, ecological destruction is another, you know, deforestation, pollution, diet-related disease, it goes on and on. So, interestingly, to bring COVID up again, you know, I mean, all of these underlying health conditions that are making us so susceptible to it, they're all diet related. So that's interesting too. I think for me, you know, the idea of revaluing food, it's the single most powerful thing we could do as a society, as a culture, to revalue the decisions and the intentions around our vision of where we're trying to get to. And it becomes very rapidly a kind of critique of the capitalist logic, particularly in its kind of late neoliberal form, if you like, which treats people and nature as expendable, effectively. So I think it's got to come as a kind of a convulsive moment of, if you like, cultural awareness that I ironically believe COVID could really help us into. You know, I mean, a lot of people are sort of staying at home now and realizing, oh, actually having more time with my kids, cooking more at home, you know, sort of actually sort of going into the garden and smelling, you know, sort of new grass and leaves bursting forth and everything is actually making me happy. I mean, these are all things that don't show up on the normal kind of GDP measure of well-being. So I think there's many, many things in there. But I think, you know, in answer to your question, you know, if I was a politician now, I would see this as an astonishing once in a generation, you know, possibly even once in an epoch opportunity to say, look, guys, you know, the way we were going was the wrong direction. And we kind of knew that, but we couldn't stop. And now we've been forced to stop. When we restart, let's go off in direction B, and here's what it looks like, and it's a beautiful life.
Yeah, and I think let's dive a bit more into that, because the good life and the concept of the good life is one of the central concepts in the book, and I think from previous research that we have done in sustainable living, sustainable life is perceived as somehow renouncing the good life, and we can also see that during previous times of crisis, for instance, during the last economic crisis, we saw what was termed the lipstick effect. Everybody went out to buy lipstick, and apparently also to eat ice cream, because, you know, we felt a need and a justification to treat ourselves with something a bit nice. So this would maybe speak for people eating a bit less healthy. On the other hand, as you say it, this situation has forced people to stay home, to eat in. We see an upsurge in DIY, because people are nesting. They want to be comfortable where they spend their most of the time, and they also have more time to cook, and it's just so funny to see, you know, the abundance of sourdough being cultivated on Instagram and shown off on Instagram at the moment. And I have to admit that I've actually, for the first time in my life, I've had a sourdough, kept it alive for more than a month and a half. So I'm also one
brilliant.
Of those. Yeah. So I think it's interesting to see what this situation does with our concept of the good life. And how do you see this affecting our relationship with food and how we value good life?
For me, the critical question. I believe, and as you say, I write about this a lot in the book, you know, basically, you know, 250 years ago, if you like, when life for everybody was pretty much, you know, tough one way or another, you know, even if you were rich, you could sort of drop dead, you know, overnight from some disease. And I mean, again, COVID's a very interesting reminder of that. But, you know, I think as kind of the Industrial Revolution got going and as we sort of gathered more science and more technology to allow us to kind of lead more comfortable lives, if you like, to a certain extent, more predictable lives and so on. All of those seemed like just no-brainer gains at the time, because at that time, people didn't realise that, you know, nature wasn't expendable. You know, so and really, I think where we got to in the late 20th century, early 21st century was the sort of really the extreme end of that sort of long convulsive evolution in our idea of what a good life was. And what that was based on was treating life like a problem to be solved. You know, so you've got a lot of material to move. Oh, you use steam engines. You know, you want to travel around the world, you fly. You know, you sort of, you want to get to work, you sort of jump on a train or a bus. You kind of, you want to eat. Okay, well, cooking, you know, is what peasants used to do, or sort of, you know, farming is what peasants used to do, and cooking, you know, is what everybody, you know, housewives used to do. But none, we're all far too busy to do that anymore. So of course, we're going to have ready meals, and then we're going to have Deliveroo, and you know, and of course, you know, nobody wants to farm anymore. So let's just have kind of as much mechanization as possible, and it comes back to food, because the question of how to eat is the oldest question in humanity, and you could say that we evolved as a species around the shared problem of how to eat. And this brings us back, by the way, to the centrality of the shared meal that I'd like to talk about more in a second. But in essence, you know, the old peasant dream was that this problem would be magically solved. You know, so that, you know, there were these dreams of kind of a world made of, you know, pastry and rivers flowing in wine and pigs running around with knives in their back just begging you to eat them, so nobody would have to work anymore. And, you know, I think, as I say, we got to an extreme end of that where, you know, we'd almost appeared to have solved the problem of how to eat. And, you know, the idea of a good life was shedding work, you know, and shedding necessity and sort of shedding, you know, anything to do with having to bend down and pick stuff out of the ground or whatever. And then we sort of, you know, a whole raft of reports came out, you know, again, around the turn of the millennium, sort of saying, oh, gosh, we're getting really, really ill. Ooh, life expectancies in the West are starting to drop. Oh, you know, we're less happy, or we're no more happy than we were 50 years ago, despite the fact that we're earning, on average, you know, 30 times more. You know, so the cracks were appearing in this edifice. And I think, again, you know, what I was arguing in the book is that the irony is that so many of the things that capitalism tells us we ought to want to be happy are not actually what makes us happy. You know, so the whole consumerist kind of project is to make you always want what you haven't quite got yet. Ooh, I want the new iPhone. Ooh, I want the bigger car. Ooh, I want a better holiday. You know, so you're never in the here and now. And again, I mean, you know, all the way through the late 20th century, there were sort of people discovering Buddhism and sort of saying, you know, oh, sort of in the East, they seem to have a different attitude, and they look for happiness in things that are present, and the smell of a flower, and just, you know, the sort of meditation and really sort of understanding your presence in the earth. And what I discovered, you know, through, again, my research sort of into various kind of philosophers in the West, is that we have an equivalent tradition, which, you know, variously could be called Epicureanism or Stoicism or Humanism, which is about precisely the same thing. It's about valuing the fact that we're alive and, weirdly, actually getting pleasure out of the necessary. So this is, interestingly, what Epicurus was on about. I mean, Epicurus has been one of the most kind of misinterpreted philosophers in history, because, you know, we use the word Epicureanism to mean sort of feasting and so on, but actually he's about the very opposite. He's about understanding that to allow yourself to get hungry and then to satisfy hunger is the greatest happiness you'll ever have. So he says, you know, we need to find joy in the necessary. And I think, again, under lockdown, what many of us are discovering is that actually it's quite fun to kind of take the time to bake a cake or bread, or to, as you rightly said, you know, I mean, there's been a proliferation of people making their own sourdough starters, which I find incredibly encouraging. You know, people are growing. I mean, there's been a study actually undertaken in the UK in the last week by the Food Farming and Countryside Commission, where they found that only 9% of people surveyed said they wanted life to go back as it was before, and 85% said they wanted to keep some aspects of their new life in lockdown. So they're learning.
That's so interesting.
I mean, it's so crazy, isn't it? It's, they're learning the joy of living in the moment, of contact with their loved ones, of spending time, simple time, you know. And again, the Stoics, who I mentioned earlier, I mean, they used to say acceptance of death is the start of a good life, because basically once you accept that your time on earth is limited, then you can live every day as if it's your last. And what I found really, really interesting is that what COVID is doing is it's making us value, understand, to see what really makes us happy. Because it's all the things, it's all the really basic things. It's being with our loved ones. It's making stuff rather than just consuming all the time. You know, having time, being able to just smell, as I say, the sort of, you know, the nature, listen to bird song, just sort of be physically in the moment. And also to work, interestingly, is another thing. So actually cooking is a pleasure when you're not feeling so frantic that you ought to be doing 800 other things, you know. So again, this survey found, you know, 42% of people surveyed said that they valued food more than they did before. 38% they were cooking from scratch more. 33% they were wasting less food. So, you know, that just shows you, you know, what, you know, a month and a half of not dashing around in pursuit of some good life that's over there somewhere has done to us. And I think these are all lessons that we really, really should and could take forward.
And that's really, I mean, it's so beautiful that it, I think without giving too much away, I think I can reveal that, your book actually ends on a positive note. And it seems like you really do have hope for us to rekindle our relationship with food and with each other. And your book came out just before COVID, but it seems like it's even more relevant now, and that you have even more hope for us actually, and that, you know, this whole situation is almost proving you right. Is that true? Is that how you see
it? Well, I mean, I think the least welcome sentence in the human language, in the English language, is "I told you so." So I'm not going to say that, but I mean, what I will say is that, yes, I was talking about all of these things before COVID, and because we were already facing enormous crises before, bigger than COVID, actually. We still are, as I said, you know, climate change, mass extinction, and so on. But I think what COVID is doing is it's showing us that we can affect massive global change really rapidly if we need to, and that's a really good thing to know. Secondly, I think it's emphasising that we are all in this together. It is a truly global problem and we can't pretend it isn't. But it's also showing us that we need local resilience. You know, so again, I mean, I think the government is starting to wake up to the fact that, you know, what you can actually do as a nation also matters. It's not just about getting it as cheaply as possible from wherever you can get someone to make it. And that goes for food and PPE and all sorts of other things too. So it's about a kind of a complex system in which we're locally resilient, but we're also globally cooperative, you know, and I guess that's somewhere close to where I was trying to get to in the book through food once more. But yes, I am extremely optimistic. And, you know, the reason I'm optimistic is I think, you know, I mean, I actually wrote in the book actually as well, ironically, about the fact that, you know, it's usually in moments of extreme crisis that the best in us comes out. And we saw this after the war. You know, I mean, you know, as I wrote in the book, you know, it was the great Wall Street crash of 1929 yeah. that led to the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal in the United States, which is as close as the United States has ever come to kind of a socialistic program. And, you know, the Second World War led, of course, to the creation of the welfare system and the NHS, which in Britain is, you know, our most cherished institution, deeply underfunded, of course, for 20 years by the Tory government, but they never quite mentioned that anyway. You know, so I think the COVID absolutely is a critical moment when we can sort of take all of this discovery, you know, among ordinary people. And yes, of course, it's not everyone. Of course, some people are locked up in tiny little flats, and they're probably, you know, I mean, there's been a huge rise in kind of, you know, reports of domestic abuse and stuff. So it's not all rosy by any means, but the vast majority of the population are, as I say, discovering the benefits of, you know, living in time, as I put it in the book. And I think this is absolutely fundamental, because it means that we can start to be happy with things that don't cost the earth. You know, this is the philosopher's stone of where we need to get to. If people can be happy, I mean, you know, people are not, they're not consuming anything other than food at the moment and energy. And that's beautiful, you know, because that's kind of where we need to get to, you know. And they're producing far more. You know, kids are drawing, people are making stuff, they're writing poetry, they're kind of, you know, building weird structures in the garden, you know, because we're inherently creative, you know. And again, you know, we've constructed an economy that doesn't allow us to be, most people, to be creative. We even talk about creatives as this weird little subset of people off somewhere kind of writing pop songs, you know, which is ridiculous. Everybody's creative. So we need, as I was arguing in the book, we need to create a what I call a landscape for human flourishing, which is literally an environment and an economy and a politics that gives everybody the opportunity to be a creative human being and a loving human being, and to sort of enjoy the pleasures of living in the moment, in time. And it's happening, and that is quite extraordinary. So I think it's just my job now is to point out to the fact that it is extraordinary, and this has to be the basis of our new idea of a good life going forward. And I'm not saying nobody can ever fly again, and I'm not saying, you know, nobody can buy a handbag again. I'm just saying, you know, this could be the basis of the new life, rather than the idea that everything that is not this is the good life we need to get back to, because it was never a good life.
Yeah, and how do we, because I believe that as agencies and as marketeers, we need to take a bigger responsibility in creating a positive impact. How do we help make this change sustainable? How do we make sure, or help making sure that we keep valuing this new way of new perspective on the good life, and don't go back into the old hamster wheel in a couple of months when we're able to?
Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting question. I mean, you talked earlier about, you know, the lipstick effect and everything, and the fact that, you know, people want to quote unquote treat themselves. And of course, that's not going to go away either. But I mean, I think, you know, this is where we absolutely need government action, actually, and, you know, at a local and national and global level. Because this takes planning, this takes economic reform, this takes land reform. You know, I mean, for me, you know, it sort of really is about, funnily enough, when I was writing the book and I was researching the Garden City, which to me remains an incredibly interesting model, because it's about, and I should just say this because I think it's a really important idea, it goes back to your question of what does a good Sitopia look like, and the Lorenzetti fresco I mentioned.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, I love Aristotle's term. He called us political animals. And what this term tells you is that there's a kind of duality in us, because we're political on the one hand, which means we're very sociable, which means we want to be with other people, which of course is why we love cities. And on the other hand, we're animals. This means we need nature. This means we need to live in the seasons. This means we need to sort of, you know, feel earthly rhythms in our lives. And of course, our food comes from the natural world. So I think a really interesting design question, if you like, is what does an ideal habitat for a political animal look like? Because it's not a city and it's not nature. It's both, you know. And what's really interesting historically is that rich people have always had both, because they've always had the place in the country and the place in the city, you know, or in town. I'm going up to town for the weekend, you know. So it's inherently what we want. And, you know, I think as a design problem, I would be saying, if I had any kind of power, I would be saying, okay, how could we redesign the world so it's not actually, you know, economics reflect values and they shape landscapes, you know, so we live in a landscape shaped by our value system, if you like, and we live therefore in a capitalist landscape, you know, one in which, you know, everyone wants to pile into the city, that's where all the wealth is, nobody wants to live in the countryside. But we know that in reality, plenty of people want to live in the countryside or would want to live there if they could. Actually, far more people want to farm than can farm because we don't value food. So I would be saying, okay, let's design our economics and let's design our landscape so that we can maximise the possibility for every citizen to, I mean, we do this with farm animals, by the way. And if you're trying to farm animals kind of, you know, ethically, you try to allow them to express their natural behaviours. That's how it's put. Now, what are the natural behaviours of a human? I think this is a really interesting question. You know, actually, as I say, we're very creative. You know, we like to be sociable, but we also need a bit of solitude. We like to crowd together in a cafe or a pub, but we also like nature. Okay, and, you know, what could that sort of average person do during the day, you know? And I found it very interesting, one of Ebenezer Howard's great influences. So Ebenezer Howard, he wrote about the Garden City, he invented the Garden City, was Peter Kropotkin, who was an anarchist. And, of course, you know, being an anarchist doesn't really mean anything because by definition they don't have kind of, you know, groups they all sound out to because they're anarchists. But anyway, I mean, it's a really interesting critique of capitalism that the anarchists, and Proudhon is another one, bring forth, which is basically that society ought to be based around people having varied lives. You know, you should be able to, you know, plant a potato in the morning and make furniture in the afternoon and, you know, sing in a choir in the evening, you know, sort of do lots of things, not just be one tiny sort of piece of a cog, you know, in a factory that's kind of making pins, you know, in order to increase wealth, whatever that is, you know. So it's kind of, I think it's a brilliant new way of thinking about what the goal of society should be, is that how do you design economics and politics and the physical space so that everybody has the opportunity to flourish, you know, personally in a way that they might choose if they had the opportunity. And I think you'd see a very, very different society. And as I say, a lot of it comes down to quite simple things that we probably now call hobbies. You know, the stuff that people do at weekends or the stuff that they're naturally doing under COVID is a large part of what they actually want to do. You know, as you say, there's been a huge surge in DIY. People actually like doing their houses up, you know. And if there were sort of work opportunities that allowed them to do that outside the home as well as in it, you'd be getting quite close.
It does really sound like a good life to me, and I think it's a really interesting, creative and strategic and design challenge to take on as well. So thanks so much for that advice, and Carolyn, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's been such a pleasure, and I think your book offers a really interesting perspective on how to save the world that is more relevant than ever. And I really hope that we actually do manage to take this opportunity to change our way of living and create a better future.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's been a great pleasure. And as you can probably tell, I can talk about this stuff for hours. I really believe that food can save the world. And if we just kind of let it guide us, we can get to a really good Zootopia, which is pretty close to Utopia.
That sounds fantastic.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.